Most humans feel that they're making a meaning when they can see their impact on other people. This is where my question, who is served by the work that we do, comes in. Every department has an answer to that question, and it doesn't always lead to the customer or the stakeholder. Sometimes it's internal.
Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the tech podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats. Today, we're joined by Dr. David Berkus again, one of the world's leading business thinkers and best-selling author of 5 books on the topic of business and leadership. This is the second part of our 2-parter, so do listen to part 1 after this episode so you can get the full story.
In this episode, great teams play chess, not checkers, building a high-performance cybersecurity team, we discuss the 3 elements of the team culture triad: common understanding, psychological safety, and pro-social purpose, and how these 3 elements are the backbone of every successful team.
We delve into how interpersonal trust is a reciprocal process that needs to be met with respect and an open mind, and how we can build a culture that learns from mistakes and people feeling safe to challenge at all levels of the business.
We'll also discuss how being part of a team is more like chess than checkers, or drafts for our UK listeners. We can't treat all people like they have the same skills or ways of working. We're a team, yes, but it's a team made up of individuals.
I love that point. And we'll also be discussing another topic close to my heart, the It's a Wonderful Life test, a brilliant thought experiment to show the impact of your team's contributions, which may not always be tied to a revenue.
We love this chat and we think you will do too. So sit back and enjoy our interview with David Berkus. In Best Team Ever, your book opens with a diagram, a triangle on each side that has the following. And I do love like a triangle diagram coming from thinking about project management, you know, cost, time, quality. It has the following: common understanding, psychological safety, and pro-social purpose. Can you explain the triad and why it might help us make better teams?
Yeah. The worst thing we did was probably let that book go to print without naming the triangle, right? So it doesn't have a name. Call it whatever you want. Team culture triangle, triad. I like that one. But 3 elements. When you look at, there's about, in organizational psychology, there's about 40 years of great research on, specifically on team culture, not organizational culture. Organizational culture is really just the summation and averaging out of various different team cultures. But where we feel engagement, where we feel purpose and meaning, et cetera, is really on the team or teams, plural, that we work on, right? And so when you look at that research, what you find is pretty much every high-performing team has these 3 cultural elements represented. And they're the ones that you said: common understanding, psychological safety, and pro-social purpose. Common understanding is sort of the basics of teamwork and collaboration. So this is how well people on the team know their roles and responsibilities, but also the context and the preferences of their coworkers. So they know what's expected of them, and they feel like they've got the knowledge, skills, and abilities to meet those objectives. They know their deadlines. They know what to expect of other people and how all of that work fits together. Very project management basics. But then there's another element to it. I call that the clarity piece. There's an empathy piece too, which is how well do we know our actual coworkers? How do we know their preferences, their strengths and weaknesses? Even nowadays, even the context that they're working in, who's in an office today or a coworking space, who's at home, who's on the road, how are people working? In order to collaborate best with people, you have to understand those differences. And I use empathy to describe that, not because it's like you have to know them so well you feel their pain, which is, you know, the term we often use for empathy. But how about you know them so well you could predict their behavior, you could predict their response, and as a result, you could shape your work accordingly to collaborate best with them. So that's common understanding. Psychological safety, this honestly isn't new for anyone that studies teams. Amy Edmondson's done amazing research in this regard for the last 30-something years. And it is how well on a team, team-wide psychological safety is how well you feel the team is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. And interpersonal risk taking encompasses a lot of different things. It is speaking up because you disagree. It is sharing that crazy idea that you're not sure if it's going to work, but you want to put it out there because you're excited about it. It's admitting a failure, admitting that you made a mistake, and talking about the lessons learned from that. All of those things, or we sometimes use the phrase too around identity, the risk of sharing your full identity or bringing your whole self to work is the term we often use. So there's a belonging element to psychological safety as well. So that's how well that's felt at a team level. Now, no surprise, right? If you need people to bring their whole selves to work, if you're going to understand them best and collaborate with them, but also you need people to speak up when they disagree because you need that task-focused conflict to find the right solution, right? You need people to share those crazy ideas that you might not go with, but you never know. So psychological safety becomes incredibly important, not only for continuous learning on a team, but also for just regular increases in performance because you're trying new things and learning from them. That's going to mean you're performing faster and better over time. And then the last element, and one we sort of talked about a lot already on the stories piece, is pro-social purpose, which is not just purpose, mission, organizational vision, all of that. That's great for keeping people aligned. Here is what we do. My friend Roger Martin says, here's where we play and how we're going to win. That's a mission statement. That's great. But most humans feel that they're making a meaning when they can see their impact on other people. This is where my question, who is served by the work that we do, comes in. Every department has an answer to that question, and it doesn't always lead to the customer or the stakeholder. Sometimes it's internal, but people want to know that. They want to know that the work they're doing matters, not only because it makes a contribution to the organization as a whole, but that it impacts the work and lives of other people, and they want to hear those. Again, that's not a metric, that's a story. This is important not only on an individual level from motivation and engagement standpoint, but you actually see in teams where there is a strong sense of pro-social purpose, you actually see increases in the nerdy organizational term is organizational citizenship behaviors, but let's just call it teamwork. You see an increase in people's willingness to put the priorities of the team over their own individual priorities or desires. So you see more we and a lot less me, which means the team collaborates better as well. So that those are the three: common understanding, psychological safety, and pro-social purpose. You would be hard-pressed to find a high-performing team that doesn't have all three elements together. And when I work with teams, especially senior leadership teams, I'm just going to be honest, that are sort of dysfunctional, it's usually because one of those three are missing.
Which one's missing most commonly, do you think?
I almost felt like maybe I should go into that. Okay, I'll be totally transparent. It depends on where they are in the organization. For a frontline team, it is usually that sense of common understanding. The roles are not all that clearly defined and what have you. For a middle team, it's really hard to feel that sense of pro-social purpose because you're not directly connected to the customers, but you're also not in the senior strategy making space. For senior leadership teams, it's almost always psychological safety. If you think about a large organization, large enough to have an LT, right? So, you know, even 100 people is large enough, but in particular, your large multinational organizations where everyone has a title that starts with a C, those often aren't teams, or at least they don't function that way. They function like everyone is the duke of their own little fiefdom, and they all come in and they report what their sphere of influence needs. So the CTO is fighting for their department, and operations is fighting for this, and HR is fighting for this, and everybody. What happens in that environment is that people don't trust each other enough to take the risk and say, we're falling behind here, and that's why I'm bringing this up. They always want to look like we're one of the most valuable teams in this organization, and that's why you need to fund us. And so nobody is real. And then the other thing is, truthfully, psychological safety is missing from a lot of different organizations. And it compounds at the senior level. I mean, one of the things I tell a lot of leaders, even if they're earlier in their career, is that the reality is, unless you are deliberate about making people feel psychologically safe around you, the higher up in an organization you go, the less accurate the information you'll be getting is, because everybody wants to cover it up at every single level.
Absolutely. And and especially to the big boss. I'm really glad you elaborated on that, because what it was making me think about is we had Melina Palmer from the Brady Business on the show, and she was discussing how in organizations, because of the sort of tribe, almost like a tribe mentality, is everyone's fighting for different resources. And the way organizations set that up is your own individual targets and purpose is not aligned with the team next door to you. And therefore, when you are fighting for those resources, you have to throw the other team under the bus and say, well, they're blocking me from doing what I need to do. And that's where that sort of behavior comes out.
Very interesting, isn't it, though, when you've got a company that all seems to be on the headline, they've got a vision and a purpose and a mission, and it's one of them, but then they kind of have this, I think I mentioned it in her recording as well, kind of an Ayn Rand model where they're all in cutthroat competition with each other.
Yeah, and not only, you know, just to be totally candid, not only in competition for the current team they're on and the resources that team needs, but often in competition with each other for promotion. Right. Mm-hmm. If I show you a weakness, you might take advantage of that when we both are going for that next job. And so that's a huge problem. When you have an organization where people feel like their individual competition is colleagues for promotion more so than competitive companies or things like that, that's going to have a huge negative effect, not only on psychological safety, but on their willingness to collaborate and what have you. It can be dangerous from a variety of different ways.
And I think that side of it's often neglected because we often think, you know, we're in competition with our competitors, but actually that competition extends all the way through the organization, even to someone not even on the same team as you. But again, another reason why I'm glad that you kind of went into detail on that one is because I think actually from a leadership perspective, when you were discussing the different areas and you know, the levels, big cybersecurity teams do have levels. So we have our people on the front line, you know, dealing with what we call the grunt work. Very tough job, but very, very important. And there's the middle piece as well that do the sort of more second line things where they can do a bit more deep diving. But yes, like you say, they still don't have that kind of direct line of influence. And then obviously there's a leadership team. And I think as a leader for me, when you were discussing that, it was so important to understand actually what should I be looking out for in terms of what does that level need. So I really appreciate you going into detail on that.
I've seen exercises in teams where when I was more junior in the past, where somebody's come along and said, do you know what you're building and for what purposes? And I think we're a lot better at this now, but building software, if you've got a bunch of people completing Jira tickets to write code and they don't know why they're actually doing it. And they don't have that common understanding. And I think actually really good leaders were, I worked with a large supermarket and they were rebranding and they actually, their leader came in and the thing he did was he got everybody on the same page. He understood what, we had this kind of long-term strategy that everybody understood, even down to the sort of the very more junior developers. And there's a great phrase in your book, it says, great teams play chess, not checkers. Mm. I guess for our listeners, could you describe what you mean by this?
Yeah. So this really comes back to that common understanding piece and the empathy piece, right? Which is that as a leader, you don't want to be unfair to anyone on your team. Obviously, you want to be equitable, but equitable doesn't necessarily mean equal. Different people have different strengths, weaknesses. They have different desires. You know, the big thing I'm dealing with a lot of organizations right now is we think about hybrid and everybody just says blanket statements like 3 days a week. Well, some people that actually could drag their productivity. Maybe they're introverts or maybe they need to do, like you said, the grunt work, which is work that you shouldn't be interrupted when you're doing. So being at home more often suits that. Other people need to be in meetings much more often. It's more efficient if they're there more often, right? Even just your regular check-ins with individual employees. Some people you need to check in with daily. Some people it could be weekly. Some people you can probably go 2 weeks without bugging them and they're still going to be really productive. And so that's what I mean. In checkers, every piece moves the same way. And so you treat everybody similar. But great teams play chess. In chess, every piece moves slightly differently. It has different strengths and weaknesses. It has different vulnerabilities. And great leaders sort of know they need to treat the people differently in order to treat them equitably and in order to get the best performance out of the team. They need to know who the go-to people are and what have you. And that comes from knowing, again, strengths and weaknesses, preferences, past histories, all of those things. You can't just say, I'm going to treat everyone, I'm going to give everyone 30 minutes once a week, check-in time, et cetera, or I'm going to make sure everybody's in the office these many days a week. It's just not... It's not going to work. You can set guidelines, you can set minimum expectations, but there are going to be people that need to be there more often, less often, play chess with them, not necessarily checkers.
Thank you. Yeah, I like the idea of thinking about the CEO is the king moving slowly one square at a time.
Well, in that analogy, too, we'd have to what call the COO the queen, because they're the one running around like with a hand in everything a lot of times. Yeah, who knows? Or maybe the CEO's admin, because they're the one that knows everyone in the organization. Who knows? Yeah. Now, no, the point again is not that everybody moves. Some people move amazingly, and some pieces are terrible to have. Right? It's just that everybody moves differently, and you got to respect that and honor that. And the only way it's going to work is if you move the pieces in conjunction with each other. You know, you've got to know where the other pieces on the board are in order to be able to treat that person properly too. And so all of that flows from that, really that empathy side of common understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely love that analogy. Really, really do. You've talked about the importance of trust to build psychological safety, in particular within sort of discussion to time and time again about not feeling like a police state when you're going to work. But trust can't just happen and it needs to be earned. And you have to have that based on the experiences you have with teams and, you know, developing empathy. And I think it's particularly important when it comes to cybersecurity to build up that trust. So when something happens, you can call on people, because people are our best defense when it comes to cybersecurity. There's a lot of discussion about people being the weakest link. I don't believe that. I think people are our absolute best defense there, but we just need to hone them. So how do you suggest we build trust with those that we need to work closely with?
Yeah. So let me correct one thing, right? Because I don't actually believe trust is earned. Certainly it's not given. If you look at the research, interpersonal trust is a reciprocal process. It's a cycle, right? Your base level of trust happens just as you grow in familiarity with that person. As you understand them, you see them more often, that you there maybe there's similarities there, maybe there's not, but you develop a liking with them. And then what happens is one person, and if you're a leader, this should probably be you first, one person decides to take a very small interpersonal risk. Share a failure, share a setback, share that crazy idea, disagree with the boss, whatever it is, take that interpersonal risk. And then that's when we're watching the response. And that's where trust has to be met with respect. They have to feel heard if they're sharing that crazy idea. That's why I love, you know, you said earlier, you try not to say no, but you try to say, okay, how can we do this in the most secure way, right? What you're doing there is you're honoring their idea. You're still respecting it. You're not just shooting it down. We've all shared our big idea with a boss at some point in our career who shot it down immediately because of budget or this or that or what have you. We don't trust that person as much anymore. But if they hear us, even if they don't agree with us, if they hear us out and we feel considered, we feel respected, we actually grow in our trust, which helps us take a bigger risk next time. And if that risk is respected, we grow in our trust. And so it's this cyclical process that either becomes a virtuous cycle or a vicious cycle. Now, I said earlier, this cycle is happening all of the time between every individual on your team and everyone else. It's a dyadic thing. If you're a leader, usually you go first in two ways. Number one, in signaling that own vulnerability. You might talk about mistakes you've made in your past career and the lessons you learned from them in hopes that people will share their mistakes with you, that you know, you're trusting them, you're taking that risk, et cetera. You also need to model respect. Actually, my question for most leaders when I'm trying to judge the psychological safety on their team is I'll point blank ask them, when was the last time someone on your team disagreed with you in front of the rest of the team?
Ooh.
And then how'd it go, right? If it was a week ago and we could talk about how it went, we can kind of diagnose that. A lot of leaders, I don't remember. We have a problem there, right? If you can't remember, we have a problem. That means no one feels safe to take any of those risks. So as a leader, you need to not only take those little risks yourself, but demonstrate a bit more respect. You're probably accidentally the type of leader that shuts all of those ideas down. Yeah, but I run efficient meetings. Well, maybe they need to be a little less efficient because you need to take the time to hear people's ideas. Whatever it is, but it's probably that respect thing. It's a respect is a learned behavior, and it's very difficult to do when someone is disagreeing with you. I get it. And if you're in one of those situations where you feel like the competition on your team for promotion is a bigger deal, it's very difficult to hear someone's failure and not want to take advantage of it. And instead, thank them for the transparency around it and honor the fact that they were willing to share it. And hey, you learned so much about it. But those are the things we do that show how much we respect each other. And that's what kicks the cycle into that next level of trust. So it's this trust, risk, respect loop that is always working. Your call, whether it's building up or tearing down.
Oh, I love that. And I love that test as well. That test is, I can't remember which book, and I think, I don't want to see Cialdini. Who's the other five dysfunctions of a team? Sorry.
Lencioni, Patrick Lencioni.
That's one. Yeah. In his book, there's a scene, isn't there, where they've done a Myers-Briggs or something like that. And they say, I'm very approachable. And everyone's like, no, you're not. It's a really, really great scene. It just reminded me of that. You created a really brilliant thought experiment called It's a Wonderful Life test, which happens to be
one of my...
It's one of my favorite movies. So I have a ritual every year. There's a cinema near me. It's 100 years old plus. It's a beautiful cinema called the High Park Picture House, and they show It's a Wonderful Life then. It's one of the most magical things that I look forward to every year. So when I saw this, I was like, oh, I know what he means.
I have the same ritual, by the way, except instead of a 100-year-old theater, it's my living room, and instead of It's a Wonderful Life, it's Die Hard. But I have basically the same ritual.
Same kind of message as well.
Yeah, same one.
Same thing, yeah. Well, last year I bought a Die Hard advent calendar, and as the days go by...
Hans Gruber falls. Oh, I love it.
I love it. Yeah, it's one of my prized possessions now. So Die Hard is definitely up there for me as well. We're almost there. We're almost there for the Christmas movies. Your thought experiment, the It's a Wonderful Life test. I think it'd be really great if you could explain what it is, because I think it would really help cybersecurity teams really prioritize their initiatives. Because from my understanding, and I'm probably butchering it now, you can go into more detail, but the idea behind it is if something didn't exist, what would happen? You know, is there a material change? Or is there something we can do to make something better? You know, would there be a detrimental effect? I've butchered that. You tell it better. What is the It's a Wonderful Life test?
So yeah, if you've seen It's a Wonderful Life at some point, you're familiar with the premise. If you haven't, it's a really interesting movie. It's a Christmas movie, even though it came out in July. It was actually a box office flop, and it wasn't until it was in the public domain and every TV station in the world could play it for free and not pay any royalties that it became a Christmas classic. But the premise is you have this guy, George Bailey, and George Bailey is depressed about his life, feeling like his life is meaningless. It's not shaping up the way he was. And he goes to commit suicide. Real bummer. I know, I get it. And then an angel named Clarence shows up. Clarence, by the way, worst name for an angel ever. Just terrible name, right? We've like, you know, Michael and Gabriel and Clarence. It's a terrible name. But anyway, Clarence shows up and Clarence shows him what his community would be like if he weren't there, if he didn't exist, and shows him the negative impact of his absence, which by extension shows him the positive impact of his presence that he doesn't get to see. And so this really comes down to helping teams find their pro-social purpose, answer their question, who is served by the work that we do? So you run the same experiment, maybe less morbid. Maybe you don't say if our team like all committed suicide, but you could say like, let's say we went on a team-wide retreat and there was an avalanche and we were stuck in a cabin for a month with no communication, or, you know, what have we're stuck in Iceland during that volcano. I don't even remember that, like a decade ago. And suddenly we can't, for some reason, no one in the organization can talk to our team for the next month. What happens? What breaks down? Who struggles? How does that affect the rest of the organization, maybe even the end users? And the idea there is that you get the chance to really see not just the negative impact of your absence, but by extension, the positive impact of your continued presence. Now, what I do is I use this just as the initial thought experiment to know what kind of stories can we capture. It's one of the reasons we went right into, here's how you could do this story and this story. We were just bombarding listeners with all of these different ideas for how to get people on our side. It's because you read the book and we kind of already knew how the test goes. But you might need to do that test first. And in that, you can start to figure out what your team's purpose is. And then also as a leader, you can figure out what stories you need to tell, what stories you need to capture, to share out with the rest of the organization, or just to keep your own people motivated.
I like that. I like the idea of doing that thought experiment, because obviously with a thought experiment, there is no consequences of going down rabbit holes and actually... Yeah, thinking worst case scenarios, because you're in a safe space to do so.
I think it also encourages people to think slightly more. Sometimes people get really confused with what value they're adding to a business because they're thinking purely quantitatively. Mm-hmm. What numbers have I pushed versus qualitatively? Like some people who do a lot of glue work, I think it's actually probably this kind of experiment probably very beneficial to them to understand the benefit they actually bring.
Yeah, it's really difficult to run a P&L on every department inside an organization. Most departments, and this is, I hate this truthfully, because we'll start to use words like, well, I'm in a support role. That doesn't mean your role is less important than a customer facing role, right? Or we'll call sales like, you know, they're the rainmakers or what have you, or the revenue generator. Well, I'll use all these terms to signify that some role is more important than others. And that's non-existent. Like I said earlier, if your role wasn't important, we would have outsourced it. If your role's not important 5 years from now, AI will be doing it, right? So the fact that you're there means that your role is important. You just need to think about why. And it doesn't necessarily mean because it generates more value than it costs. It may mean because it empowers another team to then generate more value than the overall costs, right? That's just how economies of scale work. That's organizational theory. That's like COSI, organizational theory 101, right? Not every role can have its own P&L, but every role has a purpose. And if it didn't, we probably would have found a way to kick it outside the organizational threshold.
I love that. And I think that is an absolutely lovely thought to end on, because I think in cybersecurity, we are still trying to find our purpose, particularly because things just are changing all the time. You know, for a long time, the technical controls were our kind of savior because we were able to put things in place. But as we were sort of more and more seeing is the, you know, the more technical controls we can put in place, the more the cyber criminals are just thinking, okay, I'll just go for the human element. And there's very little control we can actually do about that without really understanding and having that sort of empathy that you were discussing earlier. And as you say, not empathy in the say crying every time something goes wrong for that other person or anything like that, but the empathy of understanding what does their day look like when you put those security controls in front of them. What is the context that they're receiving that in? Are they, you know, on a, in a call center targeted taking loads of calls, you know, having to deal with 100 things at once. And then you come in and say, now I need you to do this and make look out for this. They don't have time to do that. And having that kind of empathy to understand that, I think, is really, really important.
So
thank you so much, David, for being such a wonderful guest. I've learned a lot. And as I say, I'm definitely taking some things back into the morning meeting. If people want to find you and find your book, where's the best place to do so?
Yeah, it's actually it's really easy. I'm very blessed. Burkus is a very weird last name. And so if you type David Burkus, B-U-R-K-U-S, into Google, you'll find me on whether it's my website or a social network that you use. We're on all of them. We're even on TikTok, although we don't dance. Actually, I should say in honor of cybersecurity professionals, I'm not on TikTok. Our video editor logs in through the website and posts videos on a regular basis, but I don't have that thing on my phone. But wherever it is you want to connect with me, except maybe TikTok.
I believe we call that outsourcing the risk.
Exactly. Well, my video editor is a 24-year-old kid who said, I can't let you create all this content and not put it in this to appeal to Gen Z and what have you. I'm like, okay, you're right. I don't want to do it. So if you do it, we can do it. So that's what we've done. We've outsourced that risk. But yeah, no, the point is we're on wherever you want to connect and find out more about the book, grab the book directly. This is not a conversation that's going away anytime soon. My mission in life is to make work not suck, to make it much more engaging. And I'm not naive. I don't think that'll happen tomorrow. I think this is going to be a long conversation. And if any of your listeners, if I can be helpful to them, please feel free to reach out on one of those and get connected and keep that conversation going.
Absolutely. And I will put links to everything that you've discussed and how to find you in the show notes as well. David, thank you so much. I have learned so much. You've been a fantastic guest. Thank you so much.
No, thank you again so much for having me.
Well, part two of our talk with David was just as exciting as the first part.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the team culture triad discussion. There's a book worth of wisdom and insight just in that one diagram alone. So I'd say his book, The Best Team Ever, is an essential purchase. It was fascinating to hear David's take on which of the three is the most challenging at each level. But no surprise that psychological safety is a common problem at the top.
I also loved the It's a Wonderful Life test. It's such a fun way of reminding us the profound impacts our teams have, not only in terms of outcomes, but also in empowering each other and fostering an environment where learning from our mistakes is not only encouraged but celebrated.
I wonder what the Die Hard test would look like, given they're both iconic Christmas movies.
Maybe you would crawl over broken glass to get to Yippee-ki-yay.
Anyway, links to everything David discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and a share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps us spread the word, appease the algorithm gods, and get high quality guests like David on future episodes. And just a reminder, the deadline for the European Cybersecurity Blogger Awards is fast approaching, so if you enjoyed this episode, do give us a nom.
And details of the way you can nominate us will be in the show notes as well. Now, next week is our final episode of the season, and as is tradition, we're going to do a special deep dive with just the two of us. Again, we're talking about AI and cybersecurity, because that's all anyone really wants to talk about these days, but I think that's another reason why you should subscribe so you don't miss a thing.
Don't worry, we've got plenty more seasons in us.
Yes, we will be back, but for now, that's us. We hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time. Keep secure, and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?